I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. On this Thanksgiving Day, I want you to ponder this question from Yale University professor Ned Blackhawk. When and where does the story of America start, and who constitutes its central cast? That is among the central questions he poses in his book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. In this encore presentation of a conversation first recorded for Washington Post Live on April 27th, Professor Blackhawk explains why encounter rather than discovery must structure America's origin story, the importance of Native Americans in the formulation of the U.S. Constitution, and what he hopes his students and readers take away from this book.
So back in January, the Post dubbed your book among the books to read in 2023, noting that it, quote, invites us to reconsider our received stories. What inspired you to reevaluate the stories we've been taught about Native Americans and the formation of the United States?
I've been teaching Native American history since 1999 and have been studying it for nearly all of my adult life. And I've never ultimately felt sufficiently satisfied with not only many kind of commonplace understandings of the subject that pervade the academy, that exist in popular culture or are found in other institutional spaces, but also couldn't ever sufficiently find a kind of common course book or set of materials to make sense of some of the unifying themes that expand across the many centuries of Native American history. Mm-hmm. There's been, since that initial moment of teaching, a profusion of scholarly and academic work in the field. And I've been trying as best as I can to kind of stay conversant and active in these conversations, and felt the need to kind of bring it together in some kind of overarching form that draws upon what I'm calling the rediscovery of America, an academic and intellectual rediscovery or unearthing that currently is underway among many scholars in the field.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that you use the word discovery or rediscovery, because in your book, you say encounter rather than discovery must structure America's origins story. Explain what you mean by this.
I do use the term rediscovery to lead us eventually, I hope, to encounter. And there are scholars, myself included, who are working to deepen and denaturalize assumptions about the American past. And it's just really wonderful to be a part of this generation of active scholars and historians doing really exciting things. The term encounter, I think, is a better paradigm for thinking about the meeting of diverse communities across American historical landscapes. It invites us to think beyond the Euro-American subject as the exclusive actor or set of actors within the American national story, and allows us potentially to see Native American communities as multiple sovereigns or pre-existing polities who encountered as well newcomers upon their lands.
You know, in that Washington Post little brief about your book saying it should be a book to read in 2023, they note that in accounts of American history, indigenous peoples are often treated as largely incidental, either obstacles to be overcome or part of a narrative separate from the arc of nation building. And you argue that U.S. history, quote, minimizes the extent of indigenous power and agency. Talk more about that. Things didn't just happen to Native Americans is the larger point, isn't it?
Correct. And this book attempts, you know, in some small way to refashion our commonplace understandings of many chapters of American history. It's divided into 12 chapters. It's divided essentially to two halves or two parts, and each chapter and each half have a kind of driving imperative to underscore not just the violence or victimization or dispossession that are central to understandings of U.S. history, but also the astonishingly understudied and underrecognized capacity of Native Americans to not only endure and survive and adapt to these centuries of transformation, but also fundamentally shape what we think of as conventional subjects of American historical inquiry. So, for example, there's a whole chapter on the what I call the indigenous origins of the American Revolution that highlight how interior Native American policies and trading relations and tensions across the backcountry of Pennsylvania and along the Ohio River headwater regions were determinative factors in the eventual outbreak of what I call settler uprisings that helped create a consciousness of anti-Indian and or distinctive American political social identities. And it's not incoincidental then that these terms end up in things like the Declaration of Independence. Eventually, a new kind of recalibrated U.S. government will incorporate Native Americans into the Constitution in very unique ways. And none of those are, as you said, kind of incidental or accidental. They're deliberate outcomes of dramatic historical encounters that and conflicts that we've often been not sufficiently informed about.
All right, I want to tease out some things that you Please. Pointed out in your answer. First thing, you mentioned that your book is in two halves. The first half is up until the Constitution, right? And then the second half is everything that, from the Constitution on. Why did you decide to have the formulation of the U.S. Constitution be the dividing line?
Well, the Constitution really begins the understood history of the American Republic. And even though independence came on the battlefields at Yorktown and at the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the government of the United States at the time in the 1780s was unable to effectively manage the challenge of nationhood. So the reconstituted government under the Constitution really begins a whole process of federal Indian policy and laws and governing structures and challenges and treaties and other kind of essential attributes that shape both the Native American as well as American experience. So what are the imperatives or goals of the book is to say that we can't understand Native American history outside of these conventional paradigms of American history, and we can't understand American history outside of Native American history. And so the second half of the book, which is called Struggles for Sovereignty, is not just about the struggle of Native Americans to obtain and maintain and retain autonomy over their lands and resources and community members, but also more kind of suggestively says that the American Republic itself is not a preordained continental power, and only through history and challenge and development does it become a continental and then later indeed global power. So these sovereignties are in many ways interrelated or mutually constitutive. And so I'm really trying to highlight the centrality of Native Americans to every century of American historical development, and to do so in ways that, you know, most scholars and educators really have not sufficiently done.
The second thing I want to tease out, and I want to come back to the issue of sovereignty, but the second thing I want to tease out, you said, you know, that Native Americans were incorporated into the U.S. Constitution, which has sort of a benign feel to it, but the incorporation isn't benign at all. If I remember correctly, there are three references to Native Americans in the Constitution, but what are those references and why is it important? Or the significance of having those references in the Constitution?
And equally important or interesting as a historian is that those references all come out of particular histories and moments. So the most important reference in the Constitution is in the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which reflects in a sense the failure of the Articles of Confederation to handle interior Indian affairs in a generally recognized consensus, which was rare at the time among the Constitutional Convention writers, that a stronger Federalist government needed to be formed in part in order to handle interior land policies and to handle interior Indian diplomatic and military and political affairs. And so all the states who ratify the Constitution cede the authority over Indian affairs to the federal government. That makes Indian affairs a national or federalist process. And so there will be, as there are today, historic challenges to this federalist paradigm or this federalist supremacy over Indian affairs. And particularly during the antebellum era under presidents like Andrew Jackson, numerous states will basically ignore national law and constitutional rulings and essentially remove by violence and force and other means Native peoples from their communities. That is a violation of these initial Federalist principles, these kind of foundational constitutional distinctions that are found in the Constitution. And so to understand the place of Native Americans in American history, we have to understand these constitutional and political forms.
You know, I'm reaching over, getting the book, because, and the third thing I want to tease out is, you know, your use of the word sovereignty, because I think when people, you know, hear about Native Americans or the American Indian, they think of Native Americans as just people who were here scattered about, when in reality they were in nations. We had, the United States had treaties with Native Americans. And that, I think, is and I'm pulling out the book because right here on the inside cover, you have all of, no one can see this, but I'm just showing it, all right, of the Indian nations and Indian people who were here. And go ahead, and professor.
The end paper has all the contemporary federally recognized and state recognized tribes. And so the maps that begin the book and conclude the book in many ways make the argument of the book in some small form and speak to the questions that you have, or the question that you have about sovereignty.
Right.
Thank you for recognizing that.
So talk about the role of, because it does reframe just that notion alone, reframe how this nation came about, because it wasn't just conquering a people, it was conquering nations.
Correct. And many of those nations, were not actually conquered. By entering into treaty relationships, the United States did what it did with its European allies as well, is it often concluded wars or ceded territories or recognized jurisdictions or set up mechanisms of appropriate restitution of various kinds. So treaties are the most important form of American lawmaking with Native nations, particularly over the first century of American post-1787 constitutional history, and are at the centerpiece of the doctrine of American Indian retained inherent sovereignty. It's pretty complicated, and the book has lots of chapters about this. I am involved in lots of projects around American Indian sovereignty. It's a particularly complex and at times difficult doctrine to make intelligible. But once you do, you see into this history, you see into this nation, you see into this continent in a way that I don't think most people are really ever, potentially even non-native people that often is, many non-educated people in these areas are often not really prepared for. Because you see things like the federal government upholding the rights of tribes over states. You see the federal government instituting more recently efforts to enhance the self-governing capacities of tribes to build educational systems and land management practices and other kind of essential attributes of governance. And so we've been miseducated in this country so fundamentally about the place of Native peoples that we almost have a intellectual residue that kind of inhibits our ability to see Native nations as self-governing, autonomous, sovereign.
Hey there, it's me, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, that redheaded actor from Modern Family. I have a podcast. It's combining a couple of my favorite things, talking and food. Please join me as I dine with the biggest names in entertainment. People like Julie Bowen, Kristen Bell, Fred Armisen, and so many more. It's called Dinners on Me, and you're invited. Am I saying a chocolate souffle is going to get me to reveal all of my secrets? Yeah, I am. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
In your the interview you did when your book came out, or maybe before your book came out, where you talked about, and if I heard this right, the role, the importance of the interactions between the federal government and these sovereign nations and the impact that has had on U.S. law.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that, how those interactions have actually are fundamental to some of the laws that we have in this country?
Well, the federal government's policies and practices have changed dramatically over time. And so one of the emphases in this project is to really underscore how powerful the federal government became, not in 1787, not in 1840, but after the Civil War, and particularly during Reconstruction, through the kind of growth of congressional authority. And the last of those mentions in the Constitution, as you referenced, was in the 14th Amendment itself. And the 14th Amendment, you know, which establishes due process and begins a kind of process of congressional authorization of individual and kind of legal rights and principles that are still with us in all kinds of everyday ways. Has a exclusionary practice with Native Americans, and also limits and has done so in part to limit the jurisdiction of Native nations in Western territories, because the federal government is simultaneously doing many things in the Reconstruction era. And so one of the kind of tensions in this kind of post-war period that comes to define the republic as a whole is how actually expansive is congressional power over places that have no essentially American or Anglophone settlers, in places like Arizona or Montana that are really, really under what we'd consider undersettled by contemporary terms. The federal government is the agent essentially of historical infrastructure development, of the builder of roads and forts and railroads and administrative agencies like Indian agents and superintendencies and boarding schools later. And so this whole infrastructure of what we'd call Western American state formation, much of it is done around Indian affairs. So we can't, like, you know, there's cities all over Western North America that are kind of have their original incipient kind of settlement histories that are tied to the history of the federal government's relationship with Indians. But we just can't, because of our focus on states, or focus on other paradigms of American history, we just can't see this essential centrality that I'm trying to identify. And let me just kind of also say that this book is, you know, nowhere near comprehensive. It is very long, and, you know, it isn't, I think, in certain ways ambitious. But this is really a kind of a clarion call for others and non-academics and many to just kind of potentially continue the rediscovery that I'm, you know, discussing.
And it's this theme of rediscovery I want to come back to, but I want to pick up on something you mentioned earlier. You just briefly mentioned boarding schools, but I want to talk more about this because last May, the Department of Interior released a report that found an estimated thousands or tens of thousands, that's a quote, of Native children died while attending 53 federally funded boarding schools. You write about the creation of these schools. What was their purpose?
You know that that report and those studies and those unearthings are also connected with similar undertakings that are happening in Canada. And in Canada, the history of what they are known as residential schools as opposed to government boarding schools, partly because they're handled by missionary non-government agencies, that history has become much more kind of recognized in Canadian consciousness and academic inquiry than it is in the United States. And it helped motivate a national or parliamentary authorized Truth and Reconciliation Commission which conducted thousands of interviews, published, you know, voluminous findings, and held like teach-in or kind of listening sessions all across the country. That report called Canada's practice of forcible assimilation cultural genocide. We in the United States have struggled to make that kind of recognition, but that is what Canadian government conducted researchers are calling these institutions. They are institutions of not cultural, not physical extermination, but cultural extermination. They removed children from their families, often for years on end. They were notoriously famous for their disciplinary pedagogy. They lacked heating and kind of essential forms of welfare. And their intentions were to, in the ideology and the phrasing of the architect Richard Henry Pratt, a government military officer who had been in charge of imprisoned Native Americans, both in Oklahoma and in Fort Marion in Florida. He saw at these these institutions of incarceration the ways that Native peoples responded essentially to militarized forms of drills and roll calls and uniforms and other types of impositions. And he then carried them into a boarding school environment that expanded across the country. So his phrasing was to kill the Indian but save the man. And these are institutions that intended, though they did not always yield those results, they intended to forcibly change the cultural, linguistic, religious, and ideological practices of Native American communities.
You know, Professor, I can't help but think of Nicole Hannah-Jones and the 1619 Project when reading your book, The Rediscovery of America. You and she not only argue for and present a fuller telling of our history, and in the process, you're challenging how we as a nation view ourselves. This is just my view. I'm just wondering, is that a stretch for me to say?
Well, I really was intrigued by your kind of general thematic emphasis on race in America. And we do kind of live in a historical environment in which multiracial paradigms have yet to fully dislodge the kind of binaries of black, white racial formation or studies that are at the heart of much recent American historical inquiry. And so I'd like to think that the 1619 Project and the Rediscovery of America are both moving us towards a point where we can have more interrelated rather than segmented multiracial histories. And I was insufficiently able to fully engage some of the, you know, classical and, you know, really recent or classic and really recent kind of canonical works in African-American history, some of which have really helped expose things like the hybridity of Native American communities in the American South who incorporated generations of African-American runaways, slaves, and later freedmen. We hopefully can reach a point in the not too distant future where we're not talking about, you know, racial histories in isolation, but in relationship. And so I'm really honored to be recognized in that kind of light. The book just did come out on Tuesday, and I'm still responding to kind of the initial set of potential responses, but that's really quite a, you know, kind of kind recognition.
Well, I mean, couldn't help but think of it. I think we might be around the same age. I'm old enough to remember those encyclopedias or, you know, biology books where you've got the main page and then you have these plastic overlays that one down, you see one set of organs, you lay another one down, you see more, but you see them all together. And in looking at the Rediscovery of America and having, you know, looked at 1619 Project, that's what it felt like to me. You've got American history, as I've been taught, with the overlay of 1619 that gives a little more complete picture, with the overlay of the Rediscovery of America, which gives an even more more complete, more complex history of this country. That's where that question came from.
You know, that's a great kind of visual and even kind of pedagogical metaphor to think about, because the maps that are in this book, which took quite a while to kind of construct and research and formulate, could be really interesting transparencies or something, you know, to put over a map of the United States that is on a diner roadside map or some kind of a conventional of cartography. Because it, you know, I think Google has made things a lot easier in certain ways, but for the longest time, Native American communities didn't even appear on maps, you know, and the jurisdiction of tribes, you know, simply isn't known until one often has to encounter them. Like if you're, you know, looking for, fishing in Montana, or, you know, trying to find, gaming opportunities in certain regions, you now have the capacity to kind of see American Indian communities and kind of self-governing practices in various forms. But for a long time, these communities literally weren't represented. And so we need the kind of infrastructure. We need the maps. We need the statistics. We need the primary sources. We need the interpretive overviews, which this book is attempting. We need lots of things and work to kind of reform these previous centuries, or generations at least, of scholarly misrecognition.
Well, when I was a kid, I was a big map nerd, still am. And one of the things I discovered in your book and in the map towards the back is that my family is from, I think it's called Northampton County in North Carolina, where the Meherrin Nation is.
Right.
And so now I would hear about, although my grandmother would mispronounce it, she'd leave off the end. It was always the Meherrin, but, mm-hmm. And just talking about the Meherrin River, but it's the Meherrin River, there, in that part of North Carolina. So as I dive deeper into the book, cause I'm gonna be honest, I have not finished the book, but as I dive deeper, I'm very curious to see, how all of this will factor into my further knowledge of the country. One last question for you before we completely run out of time, Professor. You're currently teaching your book in your spring intro to American Indian History class at Yale. What do you want your students to take away from this course and your book?
I'd like them to see, as I have recently told them, that it's their generation that has the capacity to remedy, if not redress, these previous, not just like scholarly or intellectual habits, but policy failures, unconstitutional practices, and other really kind of histories of injustice and negligence. So I'm really kind of inspired by young people today. Even though they're dealing with lots of challenges, particularly after COVID, they're really hungry for a different set of tools and understandings that can better prepare them for the challenges of the 21st century, climate change, racial inequities, systemic impoverishments of particularly minoritized communities in America. These are, you know, some of the, you know, defining challenges of our time, obviously. And so I've been really happy to see particularly several student newspapers and younger reporters from other outlets kind of really take the charge of this project. I don't consider myself old, but I am, part of a generation that had to kind of break into a certain kind of paradigm, and sometimes trying to, you know, upset apple carts or reinvent things or rediscover them produces sometimes degrees of backlash or resistance. So I tell the other students that this is really their future. And this book, in some small way, I hope, helps prepare them for it.
Yale Professor Ned Blackhawk, author of The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Thank you so much for coming to Capehart on Washington Post Live.
I've had a really nice time with you today.
Thanks for listening to K-Part. It's edited by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan K-Part. You can find me on Twitter at KpartJ.